Okay. How's that? No? Maybe? How about that? What if I speak? Is that loud enough? Can you hear me in the back? Raise a hand if you can. Thank you. Great. Okay. We'll turn the lights down so it's not so jangly in here. Right. Are you listening to my lecture?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I'm reminded of the wonderful cartoon from several years back that showed the classroom in which the professor was represented by a tape recorder. And on each desk, there was a tape recorder. Tape recorders talking to tape recorders, and we have iPods talking to iPods. Okay. February, here we are. Questions or housekeeping details? We have exercise one to give back at the end of class. I will talk about exercise two before we do that at the end of class. And you all went home and over the weekend analyzed your dyads, thought about the affect, power, reciprocity, argued with your parents, boyfriends, roommates. Invited your partners into couples counseling. Took your roommates to the counseling center. Did you know you can do that? Go to the counseling center with your roommates and sort out your conflicts. You can do that. So you're not dependent on your RA to teach you how to get along. So if you have a roommate who's really obnoxious, or you're just not getting along with, or you're worried about, go to the counseling center. Yes? The Garbarino reading should be on reserve, electronic reserve. Yes? Yes. Maybe. Okay, we'll check. Okay. It's supposed to be. But I have not physically accessed it myself. Has anybody found the Garbarino reading on electronic reserve? Did anybody remember that you have a reading by Garbarino for this month? No. You might want to review the syllabus now that you're settled into the semester and what? For the next class. Yeah. One of the reasons Julie does such a really, really good job is that she's really, really, really perfectionistic about making sure that she's checked everything. And she had checked all the readings, but now you have planted a seed of doubt. And she's going to sit here for the next hour and 15 minutes wondering. If it was really there. And that's why I asked if anybody had accessed it, because I thought we could relieve her anxiety. Nobody has accessed it. Okay. You looked, right? You're okay. Thank you. Okay, relaxed. Okay, other questions? Okay. You broke up with your partners because there wasn't enough reciprocity in the relationship, or the affect wasn't positive enough. This is good. I get a lot of blame from boyfriends and girlfriends, partners in this class, because we encourage people to look at their relationships, and when you actually look at your relationships, you begin to get articulate about why they're dissatisfying and decide to bail. We recommend that you work on them a little bit and then bail. It's okay. We take responsibility for that. It's part of the goal of the course. Okay, then questions about dyads, affect, power, reciprocity. Every time we think about a relationship, from now on, you're going to think about RAP, reciprocity, affect, and power. Exercise 2 will give you the option of looking at two of your relationships and analyzing them. Son and father? The question is, do affect and power go back and forth between two people who have imbalanced power?
Like a
father-son? Ideally, if you take the broad view of the relationship, what typically happens as we think about it developmentally is that the parent has a lot of power and the child has little, and gradually you're reducing the gap between them. You may never become equals until maybe later in life when you're changing his diaper, his depend, you know, when you may in fact have a lot of power. So you do cross, become equal and cross sometimes. And that. But when you look at the shorter view, it's a little harder to generalize about whether the power changes very much day to day or in particular activities. It might, for example, again, if you step back playing basketball with your father, he may start off with all the power, and over a few years you become able to whoop his butt while you're playing basketball, and he can't keep up with you anymore because you're taller, stronger, younger, faster, all that. So affect and power, and to some degree the reciprocity in relationships, do change regularly. And you can track those changes. You can watch what happens over the course of the early stages of a relationship. You can think about what happens during crisis periods when the balance of power may shift. You can watch affect becoming more or less positive over time as people sort out how to relate with each other. And our relationships tend to be more or less satisfying at different times because of those shifts, and also more or less developmentally facilitating at different times. There may be a period of time when the parent is yielding power and having a lot of positive affect about that, and that's developmentally good for the younger person, and there may be other periods of time when that's not happening, when the relationship is at a plateau. The parent isn't teaching much, the child isn't learning much, the younger person isn't developing much in the relationship. So our relationships tend to go through spurts that are developmentally good for us. And it's fun to look at them that way. What am I learning in this relationship now? How is that different? Other questions or thoughts or applications of the reciprocity and affect and power? The Garbarino reading should be on electronic reserve. It's through the library. You can access it from any computer on the web. You all know how to do that? How many of you have not yet done that and are totally clueless? Okay. Library. Okay, so go on the UVM website. I happened to go into the faculty staff page, which is easier to use than that other stuff that comes up, which is really for people exploring the university. So if you really want quick links to things, use the faculty staff homepage. It's up here, see? Faculty and staff. Libraries. Library services, course reserves, instructor, there's a long list, I'm on it, department, and course, and actually if you go in here, you come down to HDFS 60, whoops, context of human development. Click on that, search. Ah, children and families in the social environment. Garbarino. And if you click on that, you discover that it is on reserve. And it's not on electronic reserve. Aha! Thank you. Thank you for the question. You just solved that one, all right? It's not... Scratch what I said about electronic reserve. It's not on electronic reserve. I will try to get it on electronic reserve because it's going to be annoying if 140 of you go to the library to copy it. So... we'll see if we can get them a hard copy. Just of that chapter. Let me see if the others are on. Okay, later you have a chapter called Developing Child, and it is on reserve. That chapter, pages 99 to 131, click there. You've got to put in your username and ID and all that. And... ID, I mean password. Click on that and it loads Adobe Reader. My Mac is much faster than this. Old Dell. There. Okay. So what you get is a scanned copy that you can then print or read online. Either way, you can download the file. I wouldn't try putting it on your video iPod. The screen is so small. I wouldn't do it. You can't do it on your cell phone. Okay. But that's how you do it, and the chapter for this week is hard copy, but we'll try to get it on reserve. Because they can do it, obviously, because they did it with the other chapter. Okay. So, practice that. All of the readings for the second half of the course, the second two-thirds of the course, are on electronic reserve, so you'll need to do that. Except for the Six Stages of Parenthood book, which you'll read all of, so it won't be on reserve. I mean, there's a copy on reserve, but you need to have it so you can underline it. Okay? Yes? I'm sorry?
Can you give some examples of the relationship between balanced power and low reciprocity and unbalanced power and high reciprocity?
Yeah, sorting out the difference between reciprocity and balance of power. I think I said last week that these two are related to each other, but let me see if I can think of the kinds of relationships where the power would be balanced and reciprocity would be low, or reciprocity high and power unbalanced. The second one is the one that's going to be hard to come up with. Because typically if there's a high degree of reciprocity and people are sharing the roles and trading them back and forth, and they're both doing a lot of initiating, relationships in that case tend to be more balanced in their power. So it's a little harder to think of a situation where that might happen. I wanted to grab the overhead with the definitions on it, so that, again, the power is the relative strength and degree of influence on each other, and reciprocity is taking turns and alternating. So a relationship that's balanced and low in reciprocity would be, I guess the examples that come most easily to mind are a traditional couple relationship where the roles are very stereotypically divided, and one person, I'll take the traditional male-female role, she takes care of everything in the house and is responsible for the kids and all the emotional work in the family. And he takes care of the yard and the car and the maintenance and doesn't do much of the emotional work at all. They're not in a highly reciprocal relationship. They don't trade. She does the woman trouble talk, he says, and the women complain all the time. He never talks about his feelings. So there's very little reciprocity in that relationship, but the power may be quite balanced. But they put different things into the relationship. They may have equal input, they may have equal power, equal strength, equal influence on each other, but what they do is very different. Does that make sense? So the reciprocity is low because they don't share the roles. They don't exchange. They don't take each other's perspective. He doesn't do the emotional work. He doesn't do the kids. She doesn't do the cars. She's helpless when it comes to the tools and the garage and the lawnmower. And emotionally, she's doing all the work. And he's providing the income and the solidity, security, safety for everybody, the physical stuff. So that would be a balanced but not reciprocal relationship. I could probably make up an unbalanced and high reciprocity role, but I'm not feeling creative at the moment. And I think it might be a made-up thing. I'm trying to think of a real kind of situation. Yeah, that one gets tricky.
Interacting with each other and adding to each other's lives, so wouldn't that be an example?
That one certainly can be, and I think that's related to the one that Julie was trying to convince me to, and it's probably the same one you were thinking of. Okay, I understand that one. I'm not going to repeat that one because I don't want to go to corporate relationships. One, you could talk about it that way. I want to try to stick with the human individual relationships. And the one that I didn't repeat, which is the one we'll probably explore, is the one where there's a good deal of reciprocity in the activities and initiation in a parent-child relationship. But the parent maintains the power, so it's imbalanced. But you can have a relatively high degree of reciprocity in the activities as the child and the parent take turns initiating them. Okay. They may play each other's roles. Okay. The parent may have the child participate in activities, you know, getting breakfast for the parent, doing the laundry, making decisions, deciding where they're going to go. That would be typically one where you could say that there is a high degree of reciprocity and the power is unbalanced. The difficulty with that is that if the parent is being real about that, the parent is also relinquishing the power. Ultimately, we would say the power resides with the parent, and therefore it's probably a good example of the unbalanced power. But what the parent is doing is sharing as much power as possible with the child, and that's making it less unbalanced, and that's the way we would want it to go. We would want the parent-child relationship to go in that direction so that there's a high degree of reciprocity and that the power, although it's ultimately unbalanced, gradually becomes more balanced. And that probably is a realistic situation. How they switch roles? And so that's where it gets tricky when you're talking about whether you're engaged in the activities and that's your style with the child of a high degree of reciprocity where you let the kid be the doctor and you be the patient and then you trade that role. You let the kid decide what you're going to play, what kinds of things you're going to do, where you're going to go, what you're going to eat for dinner. But there's still in the background the lack of reciprocity in the role. Now, is it real that the child is really taking an adult role? No, it's not. It's pretend. It's something that you do to help the child practice the activities and the roles. But the kid knows it's play. There are situations where the parent-child reciprocity actually is very high, but often in those situations the power is also becoming balanced. So it doesn't fit that very well. I'm thinking of the example where a parent is temporarily unable to carry out his or her roles. Typically happens when a parent is depressed, for example, or when a parent is sick. We see it often after a divorce, that a parent is just not able to function very well, and kids take over. And kids literally take over the household, so they do take on the parental role. But there the parent is at least temporarily giving up the power, and the kid really has it. And sometimes one of the difficulties as you recover from a divorce as a parent is getting the power back from the kids who've taken it over because you weren't doing your job. And that's often a struggle between parents and teenage kids, particularly. Getting back into the parental role may be difficult because the kid is not going to give up the freedom and power that he or she's been exercising. So that's a situation where the power is also becoming more equal, along with the real reciprocity. Okay, that's a very good question, and the examples are important to wrestle with, in part to figure out what is reciprocity and what is power, and what is real power and what is real reciprocity and what is play. And then to take that next step, which is to ask yourself, does this really work? In thinking about relationships, does this grand triumvirate of reciprocity, affect, and power really capture what's important in relationships, as Bronfenbrenner is suggesting? There are lots of other ways to describe relationships between people. He's tried to distill it down into the three important ones. So your challenge is to say, well, do these work? Do these work for me? Are they useful in looking at what's going on in a relationship, whether it's developmental or not? Okay. So hang on to that ambiguity and ask yourself about it over the rest of the course and bring it back up if you come up with other examples. I want to move on a little bit, but not through the table. I think I'll go around it. We've talked about relations and the characteristics of relations. We've talked about activities, molar and otherwise. And now we need to look at roles. Okay? So we're going to take the next half hour or so and talk about roles. A role is a set of activities and relations expected of a person occupying a particular position in society and of others in relation to that person. So when we think about who we are, when we think about who other people are, we tend to attach role labels. So we say, for example, I am the teacher. You are the student. I am a husband. I have a wife. I am father. I have child. I am a policeman. You can list for yourself all of the different roles that you play. I think we typically have a fairly intuitive understanding of what a role is. Father is the role that I play in relationship to my children or when I'm talking about my children. And being a father is, according to Bronfenbrenner's definition of role, is a set of activities that I engage in. And a way of relating to particular other people, specifically my children. And in society, we have a set of expectations or norms about how that role will be played. And how people who are in that role will behave and how they will relate to other people. So, roles are prescriptive. We prescribe the activities, the behaviors, and the relations that people in that role are supposed to engage in. and how they're supposed to engage in them. And then we modify them. So we might have a good father role. We might have a nurturing father role. We might have a stern father, authoritarian father role. Okay, so those are different sets of activities and ways of relating that are associated with different fathering roles. And as we grow up, we learn about the various roles. We learn about teachers, we learn about mothers, we learn about grandfathers, we learn about friends, we learn about enemies, we learn about presidents, policemen, cowboys, babies. All of those roles have specific characteristics that we learn about. And we learn about those roles by interacting with them and by playing them. We practice them. We rehearse them. That's what dramatic play is about. Kids learn about being superheroes by playing Superman or Wonder Woman or Hillary or, you know, whatever your superhero is. It's subtle, you know. You missed it. That's all right. We learn about roles by being put in them, pretending them, playing them, and practicing the behaviors and the ways of relating, and by interacting with them. And we learn what you're supposed to do. So we're in preschool and we behave a particular way and somebody says, "You can't do that, you're a boy." Right? So they socialize us into our gender role. The little girls tell us what we can't do. You have a penis, therefore you can't do that because only girls can do that. You can't be a nurse. You have to be an orderly. Right? I mean, lower on the totem pole than the nurse. So people tell us what goes with the role and what doesn't go with the role. It's a set of expectations, of norms, of limits. So, for example, if I'm a teacher, there are certain things that I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to come to class prepared. I'm supposed to know something about what I'm trying to teach. I'm supposed to have goals and objectives. I'm supposed to help you learn them. I'm not supposed to take up a collection and say, "Okay, I'm going to pass this piece of paper around and just put your name on it and how much you're going to give me. I need some money. The rent's due. So just tell me how much you'll give me and I'll adjust your grade according to the size of your contribution to my rent payment." Right? I'm not supposed to do that. You look like a particularly giving group too. But I can't do it because teachers don't take donations from students for their own personal use. Although it has been proposed that teachers ought to be paid by their students, and in some system, you paid your piano teacher, right? You paid your tutor, you paid your gym instructor, gymnastics instructor, your horseback riding instructor. Well, why not here? You know, just pay at the door, come in, and that's what we'll collect. Nobody takes that proposal seriously, so I get a salary which is guaranteed up to a point, and that prevents me from soliciting contributions from you because contributions are forbidden, they're proscribed, they're restricted in this particular role. It's not even appropriate for me to say, "Okay, I'm going to participate in a walkathon and I'm going to send this around and it doesn't have any relationship to your grade." I'm not even supposed to do that. So no money between us except when you buy the book. That's it. And I'm not supposed to make a profit from that. Okay, so roles have prescriptions and the set of activities and relations expected. of a person occupying whatever that particular role is, and of others in relationship to you. So if you look at the examples I just gave, they are transactional. I can't be a teacher if there aren't students. You can't be students if there aren't teachers. So there's a transaction, there are reciprocal roles between us, as there are with husband and wife, father and child. I can't carry out my role as father without somebody childing. Fathering requires childing. And we have prescriptions for both sides, both of those complementary roles. Complementary with an E. Doesn't mean we have to compliment each other and say nice things. It means that our roles fit together. Okay? They complement each other. So, we have expectations for how people behave as fathers, and we have expectations for how people behave as children. Respect your father. Right? Remember him on Father's Day. The rest of the year you can forget him, but one day a year, and every day is children's year, children's day, right? So we know that. You had a question. The Freedom of Information Act does not cover me. I don't have to tell you my salary. On the other hand, it's on the website. Every salary at the university is listed on the website, so you can look me up. One of the reasons I won't tell you is because I never remember. I don't know. I mean, what's your salary? I don't know. People have to, I don't know. You know, I get this check every... Well, twice a month. But if I told you, it would probably be inaccurate. But you can look me up. You can look up anybody on the website through the university. Every staff person, every faculty member, every administrator. That didn't used to be the case until it was determined. Actually, the late Will Miller in philosophy used to collect them and make them available, but now they're available to everybody. There used to be a lot of argument about whether salaries at the university were public information or not, because we are or are not a public institution. But you can get them. They're on the website. Knowing my salary probably would not, and my telling you my salary probably wouldn't violate the role prescription. It would just make you feel sorry for me or feel like I was overpaid, depending on your attitude and what money means to you. It might change the relationship between us, but probably wouldn't. Probably what I should not do is come into class or put it on my syllabus. My salary is... I probably wouldn't do that. I get paid so many dollars a minute through the year. Okay. Other thoughts about the definition? Okay, I'm going to whip through several things here quickly. What happens when you get placed in a role is that you understand that role and you begin to carry it out the way you understand it. So if somebody tells you, as they did for me in high school, you're the teacher for the day. I had a couple of teachers in high school who weren't really very good, and a couple of them were often hungover, and if they didn't really feel like putting any energy into the day, they would do, instead of a spot quiz, they would do a spot, I'm going to give Larry a chance to teach today. No chance to prepare, think about it, lose any sleep over it, but just put you in the role. So they could go off and nurse their hangover in the back of the room under the guise of giving students opportunities, reciprocity, and all of that. So you would go in and you would do what you thought teachers did, playing teacher for the day. And everybody else was supposed to behave toward you as if you were the teacher. So part of what a culture is an understanding of how the various roles in the society are played, what the expectations are. And people can disagree about them, and there may be several different ways of playing the role. And those are the stuff of drama and literature, as well as political argument and everyday discourse about whether or not a person is doing the job the way it's supposed to be done. So argument about what the expectations and the norms are is a crucial part of our social interaction. But Bronfenbrenner suggests that if you put somebody in the role, they will try to carry it out. And if other people know that you're in the role, they will behave toward you as if you were in that role. Now, Bronfenbrenner likes to cite research that Phil Zimbardo did, and if you've taken Psych 1, you've probably read this study. Phil Zimbardo was a professor of psychology at Stanford, and back in the 60s, he set up an experiment. He took Stanford undergraduates who volunteered to participate in a research study, and he created in the basement of one of the buildings a small jail. Locked rooms, the whole thing. And he randomly assigned undergraduate students to be prisoners or guards. Prisoners or guards. He labeled them, gave them different shirts, locked the students who had been labeled prisoners in their cells, and assigned the guards to take care of them, keep them under control, manage them. And it was a very interesting experiment, because what he discovered was that put people in those roles and the guards become abusive and the prisoners become rebellious, which is fairly predictable. And eventually had to turn off the experiment. It's been repeated a number of times, because people played out the roles in stereotypic ways that they had learned probably from movies. But the behaviors sorted themselves out very nicely, and people knew how the roles were supposed to be played. And instead of sitting down and studying and just, you know, okay, I'm an undergraduate pretending to be a guard or pretending to be a prisoner, they got into the control and dominance and rebellion aspects of those roles, as they are, in fact, typically played out in prisons.
Oh, I was just going to say, I got to watch my play class, and I watched some of the interviews with them, some of the footage of the experiment. It was absolutely bizarre. The guards would make them get down on the ground, you push up and yell at them. They would be completely serious.
Yeah. Yeah. Some roles are particularly powerful. They're particularly strong. I have a particular fondness in my heart for Zimbardo's experiment, because when I finished college, I took a summer job for experience at the Illinois State Training School for Boys, 700 or 800 boys between the ages of 8 and 18 in an institution, and I was going to be a caseworker. I was supposed to do therapy with my undergraduate degree with these these kids. It was a bizarre situation. I won't bore you with all the fun details. But as part of my orientation, the first 3 days I was there, I had to participate in running a crew of boys doing yard work. And I was there to become a caseworker and to be helpful. And over the course of the 2 days that I spent actively supervising boys doing yard work, and on the third day taking a bus to the reception and diagnostic center and having the keys, the key and the handcuffs, to put on 30 boys who were being transported back to our facility, the thing that struck me most and disturbed me most was the role that I slipped into of being threatening and punitive with the boys who were not very enthusiastically cutting grass and weeds on a hot summer day in Illinois. They didn't really want to do it. And they were inmates. They were residents of the center, and their regular supervisor and I were trying to get the work done, and the complementary interaction that was set up became quite focused on power and threat and control, and had no connection to facilitating development or establishing rapport or any kind of therapeutic relationship with these boys. And that shouldn't have surprised me, but it did. And it also, what really surprised me, was how much I relished the power and the control and the ability to threaten. And that began to get under my skin within a few hours. Within a few hours. Now, you might say, well, you know, you're kind of a bizarre guy anyway. You would probably get off on that. But maybe. But it was really beginning to be frightening. And then when I saw how the staff typically treated the boys, I saw that Zimbardo was right on, and it applied in a real situation. And it was incredibly powerful. It was a very good lesson for me to have, because then I could say, okay, I need to stop the orientation. I need to do something else. And the boys knew how to behave toward me, and I figured out very quickly how to behave toward them if the goal was to make them cut grass in the heat. And the role is very well established. Prison guards and prisoners, and that was the role that I was in, even though they were little boys, was very well established in the institutional structure of the society. Everybody knows what prison guards are supposed to do. We know about policemen. We know about priests, we know about ministers, we know about doctors, we know about nurses, we know about teachers. Those are very clearly defined, usually, roles, especially from a child's point of view in the society, and there's a lot of consensus. Although, as I said, arguing about the roles and discussing how you play them and how you behave toward them is an important part of social interaction and a very important part of the definition of a society. How are newspaper reporters and journalists regarded? How do you play your role in a particular society? What are the rules for that? How do you teach in a particular society? What are the rules for that? And particularly related to the prison role, the greater the degree of power you are given, the greater the tendency is to exploit that power. And the greater your tendency to subordinate yourself to that power. Well, one way to think about power and power imbalances in the relations that are represented by the roles, prisoner, guard. There's a power imbalance there. And if you think about the prescription and the degree of imbalance in that role, the tendency is for the people who have the power to exploit it and for the power to corrupt. Even the nice guy who is in charge of the boys who are supposed to be cutting grass but can't pay them for cutting grass, he simply has to force them in some way through threat of being reported, of going to lockup, of losing privileges, so that they will cut the grass. And it was that tendency to exploit and to feel that power that I found quite disturbing in that situation. Okay, but you all know how you get anxious when you're driving down the highway and the blue light comes on behind you, and the stormtrooper, the nice state trooper comes up behind you, right? Orders you to stay in your car, keeps his spotlight in your rearview mirror while he checks you out on the computer, and then walks up to the window, and you know that. You've all had that experience, right? I hope not, but you have. And so you get anxious, and you know you shouldn't make any sudden moves toward the glove compartment, right? Don't reach like you're grabbing a gun. You get shot, right? This is a threatening situation. And then the nice policeman comes up to the door and motions for you to roll down your window, and you do, and he says, "Did you know that your license plate light is out? Just thought maybe you ought to know so you can get the bulb changed. I won't give you a warning this time, but make sure you get it changed." But you know that with that kind of power, the power that a trooper has, you will subordinate yourself to it. And if he tells you to get out of the car and sprawl on the ground, you will do it. You might say, "Oh, do I have to?" But you will do it. You will submit yourself to the power. And you will ask. You won't take a lot of initiative in that interaction. And the tendency to fit the role, to play the role on both sides of the role, is greater if there are other roles that support the role. So if, for example, I'll think of a reasonable one. If you are a child and you're supposed to be a student doing your homework, going to school, making nice with the teacher, being cooperative, and the teacher is encouraging that, okay, you are more likely to do that if your parents support your role as a good student and encourage you to behave in appropriate ways with the teacher and show respect toward that role. That's called parent support for education. And within Bronfenbrenner's scheme, one of the ways to think about it is that if the parents and your neighbors and your grandmother and the guy who sells you candy at the corner store, if they all support the teacher and your role, both of your roles, then you're likely to play that role appropriately. Because they're supporting it. And they're supporting the teacher's role. Okay? So the more support, the more the other roles support conformity in a particular role, or playing it out the appropriate way, the more they support it, the more likely you are to do that. Because they're all agreeing on how that role is going to be played out. If everybody around you thinks teachers suck, and school is irrelevant, and being a good student means you're a fag, or whatever else the street culture tells you, then your motivation for playing out the role of good student is going to be inhibited. So you're not going to do that. If all the other roles around you don't support playing the role of good student, if they're not respectful of teachers, if they're not respectful of the whole enterprise of education. Now, this next hypothesis is one that needs to be broadened. Bronfenbrenner wrote it to illustrate a particular kind of research that Muzaffar Sharif and others have done a number of times, in which you take a group of kids particularly, or students, and you put them in a situation where competition is the name of the game. A summer camp, Muzaffar Sharif was a professor, I think, at University of Oklahoma, I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that. But anyway, he and his wife set up a summer camp situation where they had two different kinds of programs. And for one session of the camp, or they did this several times, they would have a very competitive program where there were winners and losers and everything was a competition. And what they demonstrated was that if you do that, then the kids will behave very competitively and they'll become competitive and aggressive with each other, boys and girls. And if you set up a curriculum and program that focuses on cooperation and collaboration, the kids will fall into that, and they will become more cooperative and collaborative. This is what social psychology is about. Your social expectations, the way you set up the role of camper in this case, or student, kids will adapt to, and they will behave in ways that are consistent. But Bronfenbrenner is not suggesting that this only applies to competition or cooperation. He just threw that out as an example. You can describe different ways of playing out the roles. For example, if you define parenting as nurturing, if you define fatherhood as involving nurturing and the expression of affection and emotional availability and vulnerability, if that's the way you define fatherhood, and you're in a group that supports that, then people will be that kind of father. If you're in a society or in a social group that encourages that kind of fathering, people will do it nurturantly. You can set up an expectation for fathers, which is that they are the disciplinarians. They don't share their feelings. They're not affectionate. They're not emotionally available or vulnerable. And you do what you're told. And if you set that up in your social group and that's the norm, then people will father that way. So the point that Bronfenbrenner is trying to make here is that we as a group in a particular community or a particular society, neighborhood, family, define roles in particular ways, and if those are the expectations and people agree on them, then people will learn to play the roles in those ways. Whether it's competition or collaboration or nurturing or sternness or loving in a partnership, reciprocity in the partnership, or traditional division of roles, you'll adapt to what you experience. Now, how do roles get involved in development? One of the ways to think about development is that you are learning the roles. Remember the view of the world that you live in? That would include the roles and the expectations for those roles. And Bronfenbrenner argues that developing a valid view of your environment means interacting with people who occupy a variety of roles. Okay. So getting out and about in the world and engaging in interactions with people who are playing for real their particular roles is going to help you learn how the world works. And it's going to help if you participate in an ever-broadening role repertoire. So what kids are doing, what we are all doing as we develop, is learning to play the variety of roles, learning what the expectations are, learning how to behave in transaction with people who are playing particular roles. And the more experience we have doing that, the more variety we experience in those roles, the better we get at figuring out how to behave in particular roles, in particular situations. We know how to interact with people who are in the variety of positions that the society provides for them. And it makes it easier for us to step into a role and behave appropriately when we go into a new setting. We can see what the roles are. If we've had experience with them, then we can play those roles. We can behave appropriately, and that lets us know what we're doing. Okay, I think roles are fairly easy, particularly compared to relations, and maybe even easier than activities. And why are they important? Well, because if you're Bronfenbrenner and you want to look at what goes on in the world and what people do, roles and relationships and activities just about covers it. You're constantly engaging in relationships, you're constantly playing roles, you're constantly engaging in activities, and all three of those overlap. Remember the definition of role. It's a set of activities and relationships characteristic of people occupying a particular position in society. In other words, the role is in part defined by the activities and the relations that are expected of people occupying it. So you have to know what the activities are, you have to know how to relate, and we relate in terms of the roles that we're in or how we define those roles. And joint activities happen in relationships, and particular kinds of roles are likely to engage people in particular kinds of relationships and particular kinds of activities. So these three are not independent of each other. They're all interrelated. Now, let me take a 1 minute aside and throw in another definition. Setting. And we're looking at the environment. We need to think about settings. We're looking at the ecosystem, the context that we're in. Things happen in places. And a place is a setting. And a setting has definable physical features. This room is a setting. People can have face-to-face interactions here. We do. My face, your face. If you turn, you can have face-to-face interactions with each other. Yeah. The world is full of settings or places. Any place where two people might have a face-to-face interaction, where they can meet each other, is a setting. You have your room. You have your other classrooms, you have the places where you work, you have your home where you grew up, you have the place where your siblings, places where your siblings live, you have the dean's office, you have et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Most of us spend a lot of our time in specific settings, places. I spend a lot of time in my office. I spend some time here. And I do different things in those offices, in those places. Okay. So, Bronfenbrenner proposes that different kinds of settings give rise to distinctive roles, activities, and relations. So in here, we are not likely to play poker and have a beer. It's not going to happen in this setting. I am not likely to have a birthday party for a group of children in this room. What happens in this room is that you occupy those reasonably comfortable chairs with writing tablet arms, and I occupy the front and center floor, and I use the equipment that is part of this setting and my wireless mic, and I talk at you, and you listen and take notes, and we have particular ways of playing the roles and particular activities, and there are whole bunches of things that aren't going to happen in here. We're not going to run. We're not going to swim laps, right? That's obvious. We're not going to swim laps. Yeah. So, what Bronfenbrenner is reminding us is that every physical place has particular physical characteristics, and those characteristics are going to be related to and, in fact, define what can happen and what is likely to happen in that particular setting. Who's likely to be there? What are their roles going to be? How are they going to relate to each other? And what are the activities going to be? And every setting has in it potentially a microsystem. And a microsystem is the pattern, the particular way the roles, relationships, and activities that happen in it, the particular way those are structured across the day and with each other. And this is getting to one of the big ideas that you get to wrap your mind around in this course. And you get to practice that in exercise 2. You can pick the easy one, relatively, or you can pick the hard one, either A or B. If you choose A, pick 2 important dyads that you participate in. You and one person, and you and another person. So 2 dyads. Separately, describe them. Describe one dyad and then describe the other. And when you think about the relation in that dyad, describe the affect, the power, and the reciprocity. What kind of dyad is it typically? Is it a primary dyad? Joint activity dyad? If it's an important one, it's probably one or the other of those, or both. And describe the affect, power, and reciprocity. If you want to take the high road and the hard road, pick a setting and describe it, one that you participate in regularly, and then try to describe the microsystem that happens there. So what we're looking for, if you do A, 2 different dyads, and describe the affect, power, and reciprocity in each of those dyads. If you take the microsystem and setting, you have to describe a place and the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities that occurs in that place. So you get to wrestle with that. Julie has some feedback about exercise 1.
do. I'll just hold it.
And she has 3 minutes to do that in.
Generally, the papers were excellent.
It's really loud.
Yeah, I did a great job of describing two molar activities and the intent, the momentum, and how they're all